sci-fi show, Outcast. Welcome to the 10th Sci-Fi Show Outcast. Bit of news before we get down to the interview. 1 week to go before the drawing of the What We Can't Not Know competition. So entries for that will close on the 15th of September, and I'll notify the winner by email. Okay, well, today we have an interview with Wesley J. Smith of the International Task Force on Assisted Suicide and Euthanasia. So let's get on with it. Well, thank you for joining us on the Sci-Fi Show today, Wesley.
It's my pleasure.
Great. So I guess if you could start by introducing yourself and letting everybody know who you are and what you do.
Well, my name is Wesley Smith. I'm an attorney, but I hope you won't hold that against me. I'm also an author and a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and a consultant and attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. I've been writing against euthanasia and assisted suicide and dealing with what might be called the equality of life or sanctity of life issue since approximately 1993. And I got into this issue because a friend of mine committed suicide under the influence of Hemlock Society literature, and I found the whole euthanasia movement leading us in a very bad direction, and so I decided to engage.
Okay, so what is euthanasia?
Well, it's interesting. Euthanasia used to be a peaceful, natural death surrounded by family and loved ones in a state of grace. Back in the late 19th century, a pro-euthanasia essay used that term to mean the killing of somebody for the purpose of ending suffering. And that is generally how that term is used today.
Okay. So if the term once meant to die peacefully, this would seem to be similar to what is meant by the term hospice today?
Yeah, that's interesting. The old term for euthanasia would be more akin to today's concept of dying naturally and pain-free in hospice. And of course, the current hospice philosophy, which was started by Dame Cecily Saunders, who I had the great honor to interview and meet with back when I was writing my book, Culture of Death, is completely opposed to the idea of euthanasia because the hospice philosophy understands that each and every one of us has equal moral worth regardless of our physical health, and that our obligation to our suffering and dying brothers and sisters is to care for people properly, to provide palliation of pain, to provide interventions for depression and for other issues that come up when people are terminally ill. So the difference between hospice and euthanasia today could not be more profound.
That would appear to be true. So I guess the first question is, why do you think that euthanasia is wrong? After all, we put animals down that are suffering, so how would euthanasia be different to that?
Well, first off, we put animals down, and we're not animals in that sense. We're human beings. I once asked that to my mother, and she said, well, you don't treat people that way. And if you think about the reason animals are put down, it shows you how dangerous it would be to change human medicine into veterinary medicine standards. A lot of times animals are put down because they become incontinent. A lot of times animals are put down because we don't want to spend the time and effort and money it would take to ease their suffering. A lot of times animals are put down because they're abandoned. We have to, I think, always keep a distinction between how we treat people and how we treat other life forms on the planet.
Okay. So why should human beings be treated differently to animals? What's so special about us?
Well, you know, if we're not going to believe that human life has intrinsic value because it's human, we might as well give up on the entire concept of human rights. And it universal human rights. And it doesn't matter to me whether we evolved to the state where we could have this conversation and even ask that question. We're the only life form of life in the known universe that could even have this discussion. We are the only moral beings in the known universe. We are qualitatively and quantitatively completely removed in one sense from the rest of the known life in the known universe. And of course, that doesn't mean we are not part of the great sphere of life. We are. We are in it, and we are also a step removed from it. That gives us special rights and special worth, and it also gives us special responsibilities and special duties. We have a duty not to cause suffering if, you know, that's avoidable in animals as well as people. The lion doesn't have that duty. We have a duty not to destroy the environment because we are exceptional. The elephant doesn't have that duty, and I've been in Africa, and I've seen what elephants do to the environment. So I think that the recognition of what's called human exceptionalism is crucial because it defines who we are. It leads us towards a higher level of behavior and greater morality. And it also not only gives us rights and the obligation to try to create universal human rights, but it also gives us obligations to other life forms on the planet and to the environment as well as to each other.
Good answer. All right, then. So what would you say to the person that said if they were in pain, why should they be made to suffer unnecessarily?
Well, no one's making them to suffer unnecessarily. If they're in pain, it is our obligation to try to alleviate that pain. And I believe in aggressive pain control, for example, even if there's a potential that as an unintended side effect, somebody might actually die earlier. That's true of any medical intervention. But we do not have the right to ask people to kill us. And certainly killing is not a medical treatment. It has nothing to do with medicine. Medicine is about healing. Medicine is about alleviating suffering. Medicine is about helping make patients either better or comfortable. Killing is about ending life, and that is not a medical intervention.
I'd have to agree with you there. So why do you think people are in such a hurry these days, or so it seems, some of the different advocate groups that are around, like the Hemlock Society and their ever-changing collection of names, why are they in such a hurry to have laws passed that let doctors or, well, just about anybody, it seems, help somebody, as they term it, die with dignity?
Well, you know, they like to steal these euphemisms for their term, and that's actually been true since the beginning of the movement, as with the change in the term, of the meaning of the term euthanasia. I think Australia's Dr. Philip Mitski is a classic example of the ideology that leads to this movement. Dr. Mitski has an almost absolutist view of individual autonomy. He has often stated in writing and in interviews and in speeches that basically we own our own bodies and we can do what we want with it, and part of owning our own bodies is deciding when to die when we choose. There's also the belief, as Dr. Mitski certainly incorporates, that killing is an acceptable answer to the difficulties of human suffering. Dr. Mitski, I think, is actually far more candid than many euthanasia proponents because he's less political in the sense that he doesn't necessarily try to hide the ultimate agenda. And if you want to see the ultimate agenda, at least for people who are, where the logical extension of euthanasia advocacy leads, read Dr. Mitski's interview in the National Review Online, in which he even admitted that he would like to see what he calls the peaceful pill, that is the suicide concoction he's creating, available to troubled teenagers and available in markets. I came to Australia in 2001 to expose Dr. Mitski for these radical views, and we made quite a bit of news, and he's been reeling ever since. But if people want to see the ideology of euthanasia in its full flower, read and listen to Philip Mitski.
That's absolutely frightening. What sort of idiot would encourage a teenager to commit suicide? How often are teenagers confused and upset after being broken up with by their boyfriend or girlfriend?
Well, of course. And you know, the same thing, by the way, is true of somebody with cancer. Today, they may be in despair. They may be saying, I just want to get it over with. I want to die. And yet studies show that 3 weeks later, they're glad they're still alive. It seems to me that if we really are going to value each and every one of us equally, that when any of us get suicidal, which can happen to anybody, that our obligation as a loving community is suicide prevention. And whether or not somebody has cancer, or whether they've had a divorce, or whether their business has collapsed, or whether they have been involved in a public scandal and are disgraced and become suicidal, our job is to protect the lives of our brothers and sisters, not to say when they're suicidal, okay, let me hold your coat.
Okay. So, I mean, well, hopefully most listeners to the show would agree that medical or physician-assisted suicide like this is not something that should be widely available. But what about something like the specific case where they want to limit it just to terminally ill patients who can't be palliatively cared for or something like that?
You know, that's interesting. That's how euthanasia is always sold. It is the idea is that this is for the last-ditch case, so when nothing else can be done to alleviate suffering. But that's not how it acts in practice. If you take a look at the Netherlands, Dutch doctors since 1973, when euthanasia became acceptable there, have gone from killing the terminally ill who ask for it, to the chronically ill who ask for it, to the disabled who ask for it, to the depressed and sick who ask for it. And the Dutch Supreme Court approved that. This is a woman whose children had died, and she became suicidal, and her psychiatrist, instead of treating her, assisted her suicide. And the Dutch Supreme Court said that was correct, because suffering is suffering, and it doesn't matter whether the cause is physical or existential or emotional. Dutch doctors now kill babies born with birth defects, a practice that will soon be legalized formally by the Dutch Parliament. And they also kill patients who don't ask to be killed. Now, why would this happen? This happens because of the power of human logic. If you say, as a first principle, that killing is an acceptable answer to human suffering, and personal autonomy is so radical that even if I want to kill myself, I should have the right to get help doing that, then the logic of euthanasia demonstrates that terminal illness has nothing whatsoever to do with it. After all, there are people who suffer far more and for a far longer period than those patients who are dying. So if killing is acceptable as an answer to human suffering, and if we own our own bodies and have the right to take our lives whenever we choose, why in the world would we limit it to the terminally ill? So when you hear advocates saying that mantra, if you will, that it's only the last-ditch effort when nothing can be done to alleviate suffering, realize that if that's a political tactic, or even if they mean it, that the logic of euthanasia will not hold there once it is widely accepted. And secondly, it also represents something of a false premise, because pain can be alleviated, even if it means sedation. But also, the reason most people accept euthanasia isn't because of pain, but because of more existential issues like loss of control or the loss of ability to engage in enjoyable activities or worries about being burdens. That's not how euthanasia is sold, but that's the reason it is quite often played out. These are important issues. These are issues that require interventions, but they are issues which can be dealt with and alleviated if we care enough, provide the hospice approach to care as opposed to the hemlock approach to care.
Okay. So for those that would say, well, you're just invoking a slippery slope argument, you'd probably agree with them and say, yeah, clearly the Dutch example highlights this, that it is a slippery slope. It's really there, and this is where it leads.
Yeah, you know, people who say, oh, well, that's a slippery slope argument, might have something to say about that if you didn't have facts to back it up. But the facts on the ground of euthanasia in the Netherlands and euthanasia in Belgium, which is moving in the same direction very quickly in a much quicker time, and assisted suicide in Switzerland, where doctors are not permitted to engage in assisted suicide as part of their professional capacity, and in which these lay assisted suicide organizations are now helping to kill the mentally ill, that demonstrates that the slippery slope is not an argument, it's a fact. My favorite quote in this comes from a man named Richard John Newhouse, who is the editor of a journal called First Things. And he's a priest, and he was once asked, do you believe in the slippery slope? And his response was perfect and succinct and accurate. He said, yes, like I believe in the Hudson River.
Oh, if it wasn't so frightening, it would be more amusing, I suppose. So, In the US at the moment, well, actually in Australia, the Northern Territory tried to enact some assisted suicide legislation until our federal government overturned it. In the US, they've got examples of, it's in Oregon, I believe, and also recently they were trying to pass a bill in California that you were doing some work campaigning against, and I believe that failed.
Yes, we were. Oregon has legalized assisted suicide for the terminally ill. And in Oregon, a doctor is authorized to write a prescription, a lethal prescription. That is one that he or she knows would be taken to end life, not alleviate pain, if he or she believes that the patient is going to die within 6 months. In California, a Oregon-style bill was defeated this year. And I was indeed part of that opposition and testified in front of our state Senate Judiciary Committee. In Darwin, the North Territory, that is, legalized euthanasia, it was overturned by the federal parliament. We couldn't, in the states, overturn the Oregon law explicitly, probably, because of our federalist approach. There was an attempt to prevent narcotics, which are controlled by the federal government, from being used in assisted suicide that the Supreme Court overturned. But the Supreme Court did not say that the federal government could not outlaw the use of controlled substances for assisted suicide, just that the attempt by Attorney General John Ashcroft had been done in the wrong manner. So that remains an open possibility in terms of a national law to not prevent assisted suicide, but certainly to prevent federally controlled substances, that is narcotics such as barbiturates or morphine, from being used for that purpose.
Okay. So the next question is, this legislation exists in Oregon. Now, presumably there are safety guidelines to prevent abuse of this sort of thing.
In Oregon?
Yep.
You know, the so-called guidelines in Oregon are pretty useless. Here's the reason why. There is no independent site by the state of assisted suicide in Oregon. The state doesn't have the authority and it doesn't have the budget. What happens in Oregon is that if, say, what I call a death doctor, that is a lethally prescribing doctor, decides to issue a lethal prescription, he or she is supposed to fill out a form describing that, which is then sent to the state. The state then compiles a yearly annual report based on the statistics provided by these lethally prescribing doctors. In other words, practically the only thing the state knows about what is happening comes from the very doctors who are engaging in assisted suicide. And they're about as likely to tell the state that they violated the law as they are to tell the government that they cheated on their taxes. So this is completely unreliable in terms of any actual knowledge of what's happening on the ground. Secondly, the state actually destroys those records once the annual report has been issued. And there is some minor discussion with some family members, you know, for example, as regarding motivation, but the family members who the state talks to are those referred to by these lethally prescribing doctors. The only case I know of in which a patient's actual medical records were looked at was reported in the Journal of the American Psychiatric Association, and it showed abuses. It showed that the man got his lethal prescription 2 years approximately before he died a natural death, which meant that the law was probably violated when the prescription was issued. Nothing was done about it. And it also showed that, this is a man named Freeland, it also showed that he became delusional to the point of having to be hospitalized because he was psychotic. And yet the psychiatrist took away his guns but let him keep his poison prescription. That shows that there is no protection for patients of any meaningful kind in Oregon. Moreover, once the lethal prescription is actually written, there is no protection, even a veneer of protection in the law, to protect patients from perhaps abuse from families or that kind of thing. So the idea that Oregon is carefully controlled is a myth.
Okay. That's certainly a scary prospect when you're talking about the sorts of medical decisions that are, well, by definition, very difficult to undo or impossible to undo.
Yeah, and as I said, they're not medical decisions. Writing a lethal prescription, it doesn't take a medical degree. You know, if you give me a prescription, I'm a lawyer, but you give me a prescription pad, I could do a little bit of research and I could write a prescription for 100 pills too. What does that take?
True enough, you don't really have to know what you're doing.
Right, and a lot of these doctors who these Oregon patients go to are not even their own doctors, because in Oregon, if let's say I'm a suicidal patient, I come to you as my doctor and I say I want assisted suicide, and you say no, there's other things we can do. We can make sure you're kept comfortable. You know, I'm not going to abandon you. I then can just say, okay, I'll go to another doctor. Then I'll go to another doctor. And I can then call the Hemlock Society or some group like that and say, refer me to a doctor who will write a prescription. Doctor shopping. And you see that happening quite a bit. And so a lot of times what you have going on in Oregon isn't the supposed careful examination of values by a doctor who knows his or her patient for an extended period, but rank cavorting. A doctor may know the patient for 2 weeks prior to the patient's death, and that 2 weeks just has to do with the waiting period between the initial request for a lethal prescription and the actual filling of that prescription. So this whole system in Oregon is a big con.
So why do people put up with it?
A lot of people don't know about it because this is not the news that the media presents. The media just kind of parrots the press releases put out by the assisted suicide advocacy groups and the state of Oregon. Secondly, most people, you know, they just don't want to think about it. They think that assisted suicide is indeed for that last potential case where nothing else can be done to alleviate suffering, and so they just really don't want to concern themselves with it too much. But it's interesting, even though polling tends to show support for assisted suicide, when you have actual elections in my country, with the exception of Oregon, the people turn down euthanasia and assisted suicide. There have been 5 elections in my country on this issue since 1991, and 4 of them in states ranging from California, Washington, Michigan, and Maine, and Oregon. 4 of those elections refused to legalize assisted suicide. So when people are forced to focus on the potentials here and what it's really about, they tend to turn it down. What's even more disturbing is when they don't turn away from euthanasia and assisted suicide. I think the Netherlands is a classic example. If you told the Dutch in 1973 that their permission of euthanasia for the supposed last resort case would lead to eugenic infanticide of babies with defects, they would have been appalled. Yet today they support that practice. So it isn't just the facts on the ground which changes, but it's people's own belief systems. And that may be the most dangerous aspect of all.
Yes, that is certainly something for great concern. Now, in the film Soylent Green, one of the characters goes to this nice-looking euthanasia clinic with a happy, friendly nurse there, ready to assist him in as comfortable a way as possible, passing over to the other side.
Right. He called it going home, E.G. Robinson.
Ah, yes. Okay. Now, I noticed, or one thing that was interesting I noticed you commented on your blog, which I'll put a link to in the show notes, I think it was Hispanic voter groups and the like in California came out opposed to the assisted suicide legislation, yet
right.
At least the way it appears to be painted, it's that sort of comfortable clinic only for the people who are really sure and all the rest of it. That's the image that assisted suicide advocates, I think, seem to paint anyway. So why are they afraid of it?
Well, let's talk about Soylent Green first. You know, when
okay.
that movie first came out in the early 1970s,
mm-hmm.
That euthanasia scene, and I remember seeing it I was maybe 20 years old, in my early 20s. I remember being really appalled and stunned at that scene, as did many people, and the idea of euthanasia clinics was deemed, oh, how ridiculous, and now look where we're at. So it's interesting that a scene that was meant to be shocking is now less shocking if you take a look at the movie today. The reason why LULAC, which is the largest Latino civil rights advocacy group in this country, came out so strongly against assisted suicide has to do with an aspect of the issue that rarely gets discussed. And it's of particular pertinence in America, where we don't have universal health care. And the worry of LULAC, among other issues, is here you have a lot of poor people who do not have access to good health care. And yet we have a state wanting to legalize assisted suicide, which could victimize people who are poor, who have no access to proper care, who could look towards this as a way of alleviating suffering or preventing their families from being bankrupted by health costs. But I also think that that's an issue. The issue of cost containment is an issue relevant to nations like Australia, where you do have national resources. Think about the cost of care. If assisted suicide comes to be deemed as a medical treatment, it could be the most inexpensive medical treatment that a doctor could give. The cost of assisted suicide for the drugs is about $75 U.S. I mean, can you imagine if the belief system became widespread that killing is an acceptable answer to human suffering, the impetus towards a duty to die to save resources, it could become quite strong, particularly if our healthcare systems, in which all countries are seeing this, you know, start to have the hubcaps falling off because of cost problems. So LULAC turned away from assisted suicide in part, as have disability rights activists and others who are considered politically liberal, because of the worry that killing could come to be seen as a way of saving money in health care. And that is an acute issue for countries like Australia and countries like the United States of America.
Yeah, I'm always interested to hear different Americans and things say, oh, how great it would be to have nationalized healthcare. But I live in Australia, and everyone who can afford private healthcare here has private healthcare.
Yeah, no, but, very interesting.
So
I go to Canada, and I talk to people, and they want an American-style system because they've got problems getting access to surgeries and even problems getting access to their own doctors. And here in the States, we're saying, gee, we'd like a Canadian system. This is an issue that the entire world is having to grapple with, and we have to find a way. I think it'll be a mixed system between public and private, a combination, a hybrid system, if you will, to make sure that nobody is denied health care, that we are able to have cost-effective treatment, but we also have to make sure that we don't lose the Hippocratic values of medicine, the sanctity, quality of human life in medicine, because very weak, defenseless, and vulnerable people depend on doctors to give them optimal care and value their lives. And euthanasia consciousness undermines that value system.
Okay. And I guess as a last question to finish the interview up, what message does a willingness to perform euthanasia send to those who are asking for it? I think I've seen you commenting on old people if they're seeking something like assisted suicide, when people are willing to perform it. What does that say to the old person in that case?
You know, that's a very important question, and I'm glad you asked it, because it's an issue that rarely gets addressed in the public debate. I want to illustrate this answer with a story about my mother.
Sure.
My mother needed a hip replacement back in 1998, and I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and she lives in Los Angeles. And she and I were having a discussion about where she should have her surgery. I was asking her to come up and stay with my wife and I, and we would help her for the 8 weeks of recuperation. And she was saying, oh, no, I'd rather have the surgery here in L.A. so that I could recuperate at home where I'm familiar with my own home. And I was saying, well, if that's what you decide, I'll come and live with you while you recuperate. I'll live in my own old bedroom, which would have been a weird experience, the only thing I ask is that we put in another phone line so I can do my work. So this was the family discussion we were having, and one day my mother called me and she said, I've got the answer. And I said, what? And she said, I'll go to a nursing home. And I said, are you out of your mind? And my mother said, I'll never forget this, thank God, I just didn't want to be a burden. Think about this issue if it had been something more serious than a hip replacement. But my mother had called me and said, you know, I've got these serious diseases, I think I should do assisted suicide. And I had said, well, Mom, it's your choice. What message would I have sent my mother? I would have sent my mother the message that her worst fears were true. I would have sent the message that my mother's fear that she was a burden was true, that she was less worthy of being loved because she was sick was true. So what happens if people are willing to go along with this, even though this may not be the intent, is, in my view, it is abandonment. It is telling patients their lives are not worth living. It is affirming to patients that they, unless they kill themselves, they will die in pain. It is to tell patients that the family or the society is better off if they die because they are indeed burdens on family and society. And therefore, when you say to somebody, yes, killing is an answer to your problem, what you are saying is that they have a life not worth living. And that is an insidious message. It is a destructive message. It is a painful message, even if it may be an unintentional message.
Well, I don't think you could have made the point more forcefully than that. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the Sci-Fi Show today, and I hope it's given all of our listeners out there something to think about.
Thank you for the opportunity. I love Australia, and I hope to get there again someday.
I hope everybody enjoyed that interview with Leslie Smith, and check out his blog, Secondhand Smoke. It's well worth the read. Well, I'll talk to you next time. The Sci-Fi Show is copyright Jason Rennie, 2006. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative License, and the song Big Planet is used by permission of Nova Surfer. More great Nova Surfer tracks can be found at novasurfer.ml.